Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Port of Harlem Radio, and I'm your host and publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call to listen by dialing on your phone, 516-531-9540. And if you want to also ask a question, after you're connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 10 podcast platforms, and We Talk Production sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Well, today, our first 30 minutes is with our very first guest, Nija Ankoro. Let me tell you a little bit about her before we bring her on. Ankoro plays Florence, who is Charles Gilpin's wife, in the just-released movie The Black Emperor of Broadway. The film is about Gilpin, who in 1920 became the first Black to play the lead in a Broadway show in a time when whites would often play Blacks in blackface. Many may know the South Bronx native from Deuce, Animal Kingdom, and Insecure. She also played Rena, Youngblood's girlfriend and the mother of his young son, Jesse, in the national tour of Jitney, including at Washington's Arena stage. Welcome, Nija.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you. You know, I wanted to ask you one question without embarrassing myself or embarrassing you.
Okay.
But did you have the age in the film? And if so, how did you do it?
No, I didn't have the age in this film. I didn't play any older or younger. It wasn't specified in the film, so I just kind of stuck to my age.
Well, the reason the distinction I got was from when I looked at her in the film, and then when I went later and looked at your other pictures, like on your Facebook page and your other press pictures, you seem so different. And it could have been the vibrancy, it could have been your hair, it could have been the clothes, something.
Yeah, I can see that. I can totally see that. I mean, I definitely have a youthful energy about me. Like, if you meet me, I'm bouncing all over the place.
Okay.
I'm bubbly. Right. And Florence, you know, Florence is heavy. She has a lot going on in life, and she's managing a lot. I mean, she's in a marriage with a man who has a drinking problem, who is also like a Broadway star, which is like, you know, to be in a relationship with an actor in the 1920s, to be with an actor right now is stressful, but to be with an actor in the 1920s that's Black, I mean, that's a lot. And also, she's not a fashionista in terms of, she's not someone that's going to be at the Harlem clubs wearing the flapper dresses at the time. She's going to wear a nice, sensible sort of church dress, and her energy is a lot more grounded than mine. So yeah, I could see that. I totally see that.
So that's probably what I saw then. So have you done, well, I will say I know you've done much theater and you've done some film, but is this your biggest film role to date?
It was when I shot it. So yes, it was when I shot it. It was my biggest role on film that I shot. But since then, earlier this year, while I was on break from the national tour I was on, I shot a film. I played the lead in it, and it's an indie horror film. And it's kind of cool to be the Black girl lead in a sort of a horror film. And I won't talk about whether she lives or dies, but it's kind of cool.
Okay, well, that's different.
Yeah, and it's a really cool story. I really dug the script. So that became my biggest role since. But yeah, Florence was my first time getting to be, you know, a co-lead or a strong supporting role in a feature film. So that was awesome.
Okay, great. So are there any differences between getting ready for a film role versus a theater role?
I would say The prep for me is the same in terms of I dig the same way. I study, you know, the background and the time period, and, you know, I keep rereading the script. But I would say the rehearsal period is totally different. For film, it tends to be film and TV, it tends to be more on your own, like you do more work on your own, and then you kind of just come prepared. Versus theater, you know, you start your rehearsal period, you're not off book, off book means like you know your lines, you know, so you don't necessarily know your lines, you're kind of just, you know, taking it step by step together as an ensemble with the director, and sometimes the writer in the room when you work on a new project. So that's the difference. I was trained in the theater. I went to Juilliard, and I also went to the Performing Arts High School, LaGuardia, which is based on Fame, the Fame movie school.
Right.
So
I'm old enough to remember all of that, but go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember all of that, but go ahead.
Oh, you said you're old enough to remember all of that.
It was a big thing.
I never saw the film Fame until not that long ago, actually. I graduated and did not see the film while I was at school. And when I saw it, I was shocked at how similar the film was to my experience at school. Like, we literally danced on tables. We were a hot mess. It was just so much fun. It was so much fun. So much fun. But yeah, so I was trained in the theater, so I love a good slow process, you know, where you're taking it step by step together, and I love to like work with an ensemble. So yeah, so that's where I would say the difference is in prepping.
So it's like in theater too that you all are being more creative as a group as opposed to say being as it sounds like in a film, everybody's at home cooking. And they bring their food to the picnic, where at the theater, everybody bring their uncooked food, and you all cook together.
Yes, and we borrow each other's seasonings, and we do a little tasting of this and that, and we revise. Yep, that's actually a great analogy. I'm feeling that. Thanks, Lane.
Well, you're educating me. I was thinking that's what it sounds like to me. So, but you said you do like the idea of creating or the creation that goes on in the theater. But I guess with a film, too, that you once you do the film, you're done. With a theater, you're doing the show, then you get into your room, and you do the show, and then eventually you pack your bags and go to another city and do it all over again.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think that what used to make me so nervous back in the day when I would do anything on film or TV, because I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is it. Like, you know what I mean? Whatever take they use, that's it. But whereas the theater, you always, I mean, moment to moment, you get another chance. Like, you know, day to day, you get another chance. You can, you know, think you had the worst show ever and go home and just, you know, just beef yourself up to go in and try again and see what you discover based on what you learned the night before. So yeah, it's a different sort of beast. I actually love both. I love working in both ways. But the theater, you can't.
I guess it takes something different out of you. Each one takes something different out of you.
Yeah, I have to say it's all the same source stuff. Like it's all the same, you know. If I did the same character, let's say on film and on TV, in the theater, it would be the same prep work. So it's all the same source, you know, stuff, but it's just using it differently. You know, it's using it differently.
Okay.
And then there's a cyclical experience of the live audience that also, I mean, one beautiful thing I got to experience by being on the National Broadway tour was being able to see how different cities react totally differently to the same
place.
Oh,
my goodness.
Totally differently.
Can we talk about that for a little bit?
Yes,
can we talk about
please.
That a little bit? But I don't want to get you in trouble with any particular city. But you want to explain that a little bit?
I will not.
Okay.
I will not.
I'm not going to push you to that. I'm not going to push you.
But I always get myself in trouble. So every city is different. So I would say D.C. was very, like, they were so loving and just, you know, hungry for August Wilson. And also, I feel like D.C. in general supports the arts in a very particular way. So it's like people really, really show up for the arts. And, I mean, we were embraced. I mean, we were really, really loved on in D.C. We were actually loved on in every single city, to be honest with you. It was just that kind of a play.
Well, can you just give me how another difference, without hurting the other people's feelings, can you tell me how another city could be slightly different or somewhat different, and what do they do differently?
Well, okay, so when we were in Detroit,
Big
that was
D,
definitely
or Little
a very
D now.
Lively. We were in the Little D. We were in Detroit Music Hall. So it's a huge theater. I mean, it reminds me of like a Madison Square Garden. That's what I can liken it to. And,
you were at the Fox, right? You said you were at the Fox, correct?
In Detroit. At the Detroit Music Hall. Yeah, we were at the Detroit Music Hall.
Okay.
And it was like, you know, people were literally bringing their food. They were passing it around. They were talking back to the audience, to us. It was a very immersive, it felt like an immersive style of theater. Like, it was just, you know, our director, Ruben Santiago Hudson, joked one day. He was like, man, I came in there and they were playing cards in the back. Like, he was joking, but I think he
was
joking.
Those are my people.
Yes, and I was like, my people, my people. Then, you know, when we were in San Diego, it was a very conservative sort of crowd. They were very quiet. Not always, but they were pretty quiet. But at the end, they would leap to their feet in tears, and they would wait for us outside. So they were just as affected as all the other cities. But just their just reactions were different. And so we had to sort of calibrate and just get used to going, look, let's just keep, as Ruben always reminded us, to always just tell our story the way we tell it. And, you know, everything else will, you know, fall into place. And it did. It was just a beautiful experience.
But I do love that for two reasons. Because as a marketing person, we know that there's always, that you do have to play to your audience, and that your audience are going to be different because they are.
Mm-hmm.
And this year I had the experience of being in Chicago at the Block Ensemble. And I thought it was just hilarious because the people in Chicago, they also reacted. And I'm used to being in D.C. going to a theater. Occasionally I go to Broadway and some other places. But, you know, in Chicago, people were reacting more to the audience. And then afterwards, and this is how I reacted. Afterwards, all the stars or the actors stood in line until everyone came out of the theater and they shook everyone's hand. And I thought that was so bizarre.
Oh,
so I had to ask the lady, do you all do this all the time? They said, yeah, after every show we do this.
Wow.
And
yeah,
I was
this is
really bizarre. That's different.
It is different. And I honestly would not have known the difference. Like, if I didn't experience it firsthand and at how different audiences can be. And, you know, L.A., they, like, I mean, theater going as well. So they, I mean, L.A. might have been our, like, I mean, we couldn't do no wrong in LA. Like, they just ate us all the way up, but they also love August Wilson. And, you know, it was, but you know what I'm just remembering in this moment, what used to crack me up was, so every city I went to, I would say people were usually like really heavily on my side. They would, you know, on both of our sides, on a Young Blood side and Rena's side, because we have basically an argument about a house. And Rena's reaction to him buying her this house in secret was actually, you know, like, how you bought a house without me? Like, what do you mean you gonna surprise me with a house? Like, wait a minute. And every city, usually people were like, that's right, tell them, because you know what they, you know, the way the play is laid out. It's a very particular way where, you know, Rena thinks she's being cheated on. She's trying to figure out what's going on with Youngblood. And when she finally finds out, oh, it's a house, and he's, like, all proud of himself. And she's like, wait a minute, sir. We're supposed to be in this together, you know? So she goes through this whole thing. And in every city, people will be like, yeah. Like, sometimes I've even had people break out into applause in the middle, like, when I had to pause and just let them kind of break out into, like, their whatever cheers. And in Detroit, I would say – more than a few times, people were not happy that I did not shut up and take that house. It was very interesting. I mean, they rooted for Always, but it was their reaction was like, girl. And it was a lot of like older Black women who'd be like, sister, like, just take the house, honey. Take the house. He's trying to do good. He's trying to do good. But you have an audience like
it.
L.A., you know, people in L.A. who are a lot of homeowners and, you know, some people pretty wealthy, you know, they're like, yeah, that's right. You want to pick out that bathroom. And you know what I'm saying? So it was different. It was different.
I love it because I love Detroit, too, and I have my Detroit stories, and I tell you, Detroit is my home.
Oh, I love Detroit.
It's like, I come from Gary, Detroit. And so Detroit is like a bigger version of Gary. So that's why I can relate to it.
Yes, Dominique Marceau, the playwright, came and flew out there to because she's from Detroit, and she, actually, I'm doing a play of hers next year at the Signature in New York, but she flew out there to take us on a Black tour of a Black history tour of Detroit. And that was phenomenal, phenomenal. It was one of the most unforgettable experiences of my life.
Okay. Well, let me switch subjects again or back to the main subject.
Yeah.
And that is, we've had a good conversation about you and life and I love it, but I also want to know your personal opinion on Gilpin. On why don't we know more about him? And I say that because one of the things that attracted me to the Black Emperor of Broadway was that I didn't know nothing about this guy. And after I saw the movie, I learned, or through the movie and then after the movie, I learned that Paul Robeson played the part. Then afterwards, I learned that Ossie Davis played the part. And I said, okay, now why do I know those two but not Gilpin? What is your take on that?
I think he was erased. He was erased. He spoke up. He was the one who refused. He was combative with O'Neill at a time when, I mean, it's, you know.
And O'Neill's the playwright, people.
O'Neill's the playwright. Oh, yes. O'Neill is the playwright. And, you know, it's interesting because, we laud O'Neill as, like, this incredible playwright. And he is. He was. But Gilpin was an incredible actor. I mean, we're talking about sold out houses, you know. I mean, we're talking about people would be hard pressed to get a ticket. Like, he was a sensation. And, you know, he spoke up and he was shut down. And I think he was erased like so many Black people are erased in this country. It behooves some people to not let us know that, you know, we had a huge Broadway star, you know, like we can be big on Broadway or in any medium. And I think, especially in the 20s, like that was a big deal that he did that. And I just think, you know, I went to a junior high school in the Bronx and, you know, our books were like older than dirt. You know, our history books were old. The only thing we learned about was Dr. King. And I think they might have touched on Malcolm X, maybe.
Right.
Definitely Rosa Parks. And that was the extent of Black history, you know. And I think it's purposeful. I think it's intentional. I think, you know, the less we know about ourselves, the less empowered we are and the less we're looking to other people to define us and to say yes to us, you know. But you have somebody like Gilpin who decided to say yes to himself. He decided to be a Broadway star before he was a Broadway star, you know.
That's
when
true.
It didn't even look like it was possible. Like, I mean, nobody was, you know, at this time it would have been a white person putting on a Black face to play his role. So it was revolutionary.
All of that is true, but still, you know, and I wrestled with everything you said. Sincerely, I did. I thought about it, but I was still puzzled. Okay, Robeson was no mouse either. Robeson. He wasn't a runaway. He didn't run away from things.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a mouse.
Neither was
Ossie Davis. And Ossie Davis and his wife are together. They have an image as being resistors.
Right.
And so I kept thinking.
Well, now that I think about it. Mm-hmm.
Second thing, what did this man do to be thrown under the bus and then have the bus thrown in the ocean?
Yeah. Well, I think the difference between Robeson and Davis and Gilpin, Robeson and Davis, they actually were on film. They were sort of immortalized on film. And so they got there, even if they started with smaller roles or however they began, they got there on film. So it's like, you know, this, you know, if anything is on film, it's at some point, and especially good film, like it'll get out there. And you know,
well,
unfortunately,
maybe that's
Gilpin
what it
did
is.
Not get there. Yeah.
So
you made me think of it, Wayne, like in this moment.
Well, that's good. That's what our magazine is about. Make people think. So,
yeah.
So I guess you're saying that he never made it to film.
Yeah, he never made it to the film. Mm-mm.
Okay.
No.
So
and Robeson took over, and that's how Robeson got his big break on film.
So that was probably the distinction. They made the film, and he didn't.
Yeah,
that's one distinction
I'm
at least.
Thinking so.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm thinking so.
Well, there were some parts and things in the movie that have stayed with me. Of course, you see that one, do you?
Ooh, do tell.
So let me tell you about some others, and maybe you can share with me how you process them and share with our listeners how you process them or how you remember them or how you relate to them in any way that you choose. And one of them was the power of the writer. I thought the guy, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, who played the part of O'Neill. He was, to me, he became O'Neill. You remember his name? I'm sorry, I can't.
John Hensley, I believe.
That sounds about right.
Hensley, I think is his last name.
I remember the Hensley name being there. But, you know, he became John, because I didn't know who John O'Neill is either, so I looked that up. But the point is that, you know, he asserted his power as a writer. And I mean, he clarified from my point of view, what it is to be a writer. And, you know, with us having a magazine, I often recall or tell people that, you know, we present things in a different way and we present different pieces of information. So you walk away with a different view of the world than say if you looked at someone else. And so he reminded me of that. And despite the fact that I do publish Port of Harlem, it reminded me that I should be more thankful to people who are playwrights and who are producers.
Because I went to Juilliard and it was drilled into all of us that the writer is king, because in the theater the writer is king. And,
I didn't know that. I didn't know that you all taught that though.
Yeah, like we're taught to really, really honor and respect the written word.
Okay.
Yeah, like the writer of this film, he said, he remarked one day, he said, you know, you had every word down. Like, you did not change anything. You know, a lot of times in film, people add a little, they do a little this, a little that. I didn't, and I don't usually, because that's how I was trained. I do believe in the power of the written word, and I believe in the power of the writer. Now, I do believe that if you don't agree with a writer, then maybe that's not the project for you, because ultimately that's the story they're creating, you know? So
gotcha.
I think it's the actor's job to embody and imbue the, you know, the character with life. And yes, I do think that actors do have some power. And I think, you know, if there's something, just a little something they want to nitpick on or kind of discuss, maybe they can open up the writer's mind to something. But I think for the most part, I believe in, okay, that's your story. You know, do I get on board or not? You know?
Gotcha.
But I have the power of no. You know what I'm saying? I have the power of no. But if I say yes, I got to get on board with the story you're telling.
So going back to my earlier question about film and theater, the differences, is there one that where the writer has more openness to actors adding, or like in the theater, it sounds like my first guess would be in the theater that you as an actor would have a little bit more say in that how things end up, whereas in a film you may not have as much input.
Now, are you talking about in the words or in the whole structure of the piece?
Like
in the whole
both.
Artistic vision? Is that like,
both, or you can separate them. both where you can separate.
Yeah, in the theater, the words are king. Like, I remember Ruben Santiago Hudson showing up one day and had us all pulling out our scripts. Now, this is after months of doing this play, and he was like, let's just read it and make sure you get every the and everything. That's how serious it is. But in film, oftentimes, I mean, you'll get different kinds of writers, different directors, but in film, oftentimes, it's a lot more loose in that, you know, great, I don't think they're going to throw away a whole take because you threw in an and a, you know what I mean? So that part is different. But what's cool about the theater is it feels more, usually, if you get a director, pretty collaborative. Like, you can bring your experiences and, you know, and maybe, you know, help to sort of shift how something is directed and, you know, just based on who you are. And it just feels like a collaboration more than a lot of film and TV, definitely more than TV. TV, you know, a lot of times you just kind of have to get it done, you know?
Gotcha.
So, yeah, and then in theater, you get a lot more rehearsal time. I mean, you know, it's not uncommon to rehearse for a month, you know, 3 weeks, a month, a full month of, like, all-day rehearsing for 6 days a week, you know. That's kind of cool. Oftentimes with TV, it's like you might get a table read, and then, you know, then it's sort of like, all right, tomorrow we'll be, you know, blocking this thing, and we'll just go up and do it, you know.
Okay. And then toward the end, the other part that stuck with me is you're leaving him. I don't mean you personally, but your character leaving him. It, you know, it sort of seemed like it was going to come because, you know, he was drinking so much and it seemed like he had a hard time dealing with his fame and then dealing with the struggles he had as a black actor and dealing with this white guy who had a different concept of what a black person was. And so I see in real life, though, he had three wives, and I guess you played wife number two? Or you played a mixture of two and three?
Well, in the film, I actually technically was not his wife, but in real life, she was his wife. So you know, that's where it sort of gets a little bit, you know, sort of gray when it comes to, you know, something that's based on a true story, because it's just based on a true story. So I would say in the film it would be the closest thing I could say is wife one and two. You know what I mean? But in the film, for more dramatic purposes, he didn't actually marry her. I'm not 100% sure if it's clear in that cut, in the, you know, the latest cut of it, but I know that that was a part of the story before.
Okay, and so did you take anything away from that? Because, again, what I took away from it is that, you know, here we go again, a man, but in particular a black man, who had to fight the demons of breaking out of the traditional role of being a helper, you know, a maid, not a maid, but a driver or a cook.
Uh-huh.
And then he becomes a porter, but he becomes a star and he's making lots of money and he turns to drinking to solve his issues.
Well, I think it's sort of, I mean, you know, we can definitely take that story and put it in today's, you know, world. Demons are demons, you know, and I think we have enough to contend with, period, as black people at any time period in this country, you know? So it's like, it's how we decide to deal with them, you know, whether it's yoga, drinking, drugs, you know, shopping, like it could be so many different ways people deal with their stuff. And that happens to be a way he dealt with his stuff. And I do think Florence was super supportive, as long as she could be, you know, she did her best to be there for him. But, you know, as I've learned in life, you know, you can't do somebody's work for them, you know, like you can't fix their problems for them. You can only, you know, you can only support them, you know, and hold space for them. But at some point you have to just say, okay, this person is who they're, you know, who they're going to be to me. And it seems like she made, and it was a hard decision for her. It was a rough decision for her to leave, the love of her life.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me. And I know the film comes out, I think it's already on
out on yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes, it is.
It's on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on DVD this week.
Yes, yes.
Is that
that's
correct? Yeah. And
yep.
if anybody,
that's
and they can
correct.
Always go also, if you forget the title, which I hope you don't, you can always go on portofharlem.net and you will see the title there and a whole story on it. And we'll probably, remind people, well, you'll get this will be on several podcasts and on our webpage too. So as you get the name of the movie, The Black Emperor of Broadway. It was definitely
awesome.
Worth it. And I'm not a person to sit there and watch films because I have nothing else better to do. I mean, I have to watch a film because I want to. And this one, I wanted to, and then I end up saying, oh, this was worth my time.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad to,
Wayne, this has been a pleasure.
Well, likewise, and looking forward to seeing more from you.
Yes, thank you so much. Have a blessed and beautiful one.
You too. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back with our next guest from D.C. and from Memphis, Tennessee. 1 second, please. Hello, this is Wayne with Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Is this Maria? Okay, maybe not. I got the wrong person. Let's see.
You can't hear me?
Hi, Maria. This is Wayne Young. How are you? Are you online now?
Yeah, I'm online. I'm here.
Okay, great. I just wanted to make sure. Again, I want to welcome people back to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your question in the comment box. You can also call to listen to us by dialing on your phone at 516-531-9540. And if you want to also ask a question after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. Before I talk to my next two guests, my two guests for this half hour are Maria Manuela Goñez. I hope I pronounced that halfway correct.
Goñez.
There we go. Okay. She's artistic
yeah,
director.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
Okay, thank you. She's artistic director of Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And coming on board is the Bukundeo Bandele, founder and executive director of Hattie Lou Theater, in the capital of the Mid-South, Memphis, Tennessee. We're going to talk about their new productions in the virtual age. And so we're going to talk to Maria first, and then we're going to bring in our next guest. And then we'll talk to both of them together. And again, the next guest would be Bukundeo. Bukundeo, are you there? Okay, he's not on yet, but he'll be on soon. So Woolly Mammoth right now is offering a unique theatrical telephone experience, while Hattie Lou will offer a mixture of scenes from their 2008 production of God's Trombones by James Bolden Johnson, followed by a brief discussion facilitated by a leading member of Memphis clergy via Zoom. So Maria, let's talk to you first. I would love to say that I have seen your new production, Human Resources, but of course, because of the pandemic, I have to say I heard it. And interestingly, I heard it on the telephone. How did this idea of delivering 3 to 5 minute theater performance over the phone come about? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I think I might have made a mistake here. Let me get right back to you. Let me re-answer.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here. This is Wayne. Yeah, Maria,
hey,
are you there?
Maria, I'm here. Yeah,
okay,
I'm here.
Okay, great. Okay, you want me to re-ask? Go ahead. Were you able to hear hear the question? Okay, go ahead then. This is your floor.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and I'm so excited to talk to you and everybody about the Telephonic Literary Union's new piece called Human Resources in collaboration with Woolly Mammoth Theater Company. It is a version, it is our take on a customer service hotline. We got connected to the Telephonic Literary Union before the pandemic, and Woolly Mammoth is a theater that defies convention. We always lean into non-traditional experiences and theater that is exhilarating but also unexpected. And so what's more unexpected than to get a phone number and a code and start to listen to a theatrical experience over the phone and actually let the journey take you wherever it takes you? Because, you press 1 if you're unhappy, you press 2 if you have this, if you press 3 if you have this. And so there is, there's just so much adventure in it, and I was really excited about being making it happen. When the pandemic happened, we hit the gas on it because we said, well, this is a great way to be making art with people in a way that is safe for everyone. So we commissioned writers, we commissioned a composer. I want to tell your listeners that there is a super secret happiness code. a super secret code that you can find in the hotline, but I'm not going to tell you where it is, but let's see if you get it and you try and find it and you can listen to it. And it was a great way to keep actually making art during a pandemic, during this difficult time of this, in our country.
Oh, okay. But you did start this before the pandemic started? Or you started talking to them beforehand?
Yeah, we've been talking to them beforehand. Yeah, we had been talking to them beforehand because he specialized in like making theater, doing things that expands what the definition of theater could be. So we had started talking to them, but once the pandemic hit, we said, let's do it now. Let's make it happen now. So it was actually, we put it into high gear.
Okay. Yeah, because it seemed like it was done specifically for the pandemic, but this was really saying it was already in the works anyway.
It was already in the works. I think what the reason why it feels like it was specifically for the pandemic is because the writers were writing their pieces during the quarantine. So we basically said, let's go ahead and make this happen and write a piece. And the whole idea is that it is our take, our version of a human resources hotline. And what are the offerings? Like, how can you feel more human in this moment of isolation? And what are the offerings that we can give you to be able to, experience that or think about that in some way? And so we definitely did tailor some of it to what's happening now in the world. Because it felt like it needed to be responsive to what was happening in the world. So it's definitely influenced by the time, too.
Yeah, but I was just thinking that the setup was being responsive because so many people are finding ways to deliver their product in this situation. And this one seemed to be so different and so unique. But again, as you mentioned already, so expected since it's from Woolly, because you all do the unusual.
Yeah. Exactly.
So my experience with it was that, I got it and I didn't quite understand it because it was so different when I first got the information about it. But I was intrigued by it because it was only $7, number one. And then when I actually used it, I was confused at the beginning because I was expecting something to be literal because most of life, too much of life is literal. And then I thought, well, this is Woolly. So it must be not ABC. It must be CBA. And so when I calmed down,
I'm so glad that you know us so well. You know us so well.
We'll talk about this some more too. So after I saw that, I was like, after I heard a couple, after the first one I did, but maybe like 2 seconds, I said, "Oh, this is really cool. I could just do this for a while." And So I really enjoyed it because it broke up my evening into something that was different. And so have you got other feedback from it?
Yeah, I definitely have. You know, we've been testing it now for a couple of weeks because, you know, some of the things, you know, just for your you'll notice in the hotline, sometimes the hotline misbehaves and you get kicked off.
That didn't happen to you.
Well, sometimes it happens. So essentially one of the things that the feedback we've been getting a lot is basically trying to figure out what is that line with sort of pushing the envelope and being unexpected and unusual and going too far in that direction so that folks actually aren't able to take the invitation and just enjoy it, you know, because it feels too outside of the box or something like that. So it's been really fun to figure out what are the things that, like, there are some people who love getting kicked off of the hotline, and then there are some people who are like, God, I really wish I could, you know, press pound and go back to this thing or whatever. And there was one moment where we were like, you know, it would be really great to be able to listen to that poem again. There's a poem in it. And then they created the poem in lots of different sort of ways, which you can also listen to in some way. So it's basically like figuring out what are the things that will be exciting to people, but also keep them tuned in. So I feel like it's one big experiment, right, of like whether or not people are going to listen. And frankly, on the audience sort of, we just actually started today with open to the general public. And so really we're able to see how long people spend on the hotline. And we're able to see whether or not people spend 5 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes. I had a friend, a connection to Wooly, who, you know, was on for like an hour just trying every single possible permutation of the phone tree.
Yeah, and that could be a little bit long because you said a phone tree. Just to give a clear explanation, if I can, or repeat the explanation to people.
Please.
You know, you just don't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You go through one, and you have maybe 10 choices, or three choices maybe. And those three choices would take you different places, and you'll get a different response. So you can start all over at the top again, and then go to point two at the point one, and you'll get a different response. And so, yeah, you literally can do it for like being in a maze. You can go and hit different short stories or different portions of it, and you have a whole total different experience than the person sitting next to you.
That's exactly right, because some people will start with one. Some people will go down the rabbit hole of tech support, but some people will never go to tech support and will stay in the rabbit hole of the first one or the last one or go to the general inquiries part, you know? So everybody basically has their own unique experience. You sort of have to let go and let your curiosity guide you, you know?
And I think the last sentence you made it explains who I was. I had to let go and just be free enough to just go.
Exactly.
And when I did that, I enjoyed it.
Good. That's great. That makes that means that we were successful. That's really, really great to hear.
Yeah, and I hope that more people enjoy it too. But, you know, it reminds me of another show that you did called Fairview. Were you there when Fairview was produced?
Oh, yeah. That was the first show of my inaugural season. That's the project that I joined Wooly in September of 2018, and my first season of plays that I programmed started with Fairview. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the one of all the plays that I've seen and reviewed at Wooly. That's the one that sticks with me for several reasons. And one of them was because a week before I was at the Alexandria Black History Museum, and they did a similar topic. And I thought it was just something I needed to do because you were doing a similar topic, but it was totally different. And and I'm going to ask you this question because you already answered part of it, I think. But, you know, once before that, Wooly, and I know it's a bathroom, I believe it said he, she, they. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's gender neutral bathrooms, yeah.
Yeah, but does it say he, she, they? Because I've seen gender-neutral bathroom before, but this one stood out from me.
It did say that? I don't know.
I don't know.
But
whatever
know.
It is,
that I
whatever,
I didn't think that we put any I don't think we used any pronouns on the bathrooms, because actually we had been talking about doing something where we didn't even have figures of all. You know how sometimes the bathrooms have icons of,
right.
you know, little stick figures or whatever. We were talking about having them be mammoths or woolly mammoths or something like that, so that folks didn't actually have to be on the bathroom. But we believe in gender inclusivity, and we basically have a practice of doing gender pronouns, like stating our gender pronouns and stuff in our bios and on our websites, because, you know, one of our core values is radical inclusivity, so that folks actually feel comfortable to be at Woolly Mammoth, to work at Woolly Mammoth, to be in the audience at Woolly Mammoth, and know that they're not going to be bothered, you know,
Well, that's what I'm leading to, because I saw that at one outing there. And so that sort of took me to such a loop. I took a picture of it, and I put it on my Facebook page. And, you know, most of our readers are open and are into that. So that was an issue. But we know we have a few who had to deal with it. And so the mm-hmm. second time, or the next time I came, or the next couple of times I came, you had Fairview. And at Fairview, mm-hmm. you know, afterwards was a discussion basically about race and white supremacy. And afterwards, you had talks. And you broke mm-hmm. the audience in two, the whites went one place, the people who identified as black went another place, and we all sat down. Now, I've already gotten your emails where you already say he, she, they. And so me being even publisher of an inclusive, diverse Pan-African magazine, I'm already there, I thought. So I sit down, and the guy asked, the first thing he asked, well, how does everyone define themselves? And, you know, I was thinking black, white, African, whatever. But he said, no, he, she, they. And it was the first time mm-hmm. I was confronted personally to have to answer that question. And I had to think about it. Because I'm thinking, why do I even have to answer it? And why am I answering it? And what is that? Why do I need to know? And why do he need to know? And I thought it was one of those moments where I took something for granted. And now I had to really digest everything that it meant. Or more than what it meant than what I had thought previously. So that was.
I appreciate hearing that, and I appreciate that so much. You know, one of the reasons why we do that in the beginning, in that introduction, and I know exactly what you're talking about, because we do it even whenever we're meeting new people, whenever new staff members come, whenever new artists come, is because, you know, some people want to. People should be identified by the way that they want to be identified. And
exactly.
sometimes we make assumptions. And when we make assumptions, that can lead to some really terrible moments and a lot of pain. And so why not just be upfront about how it is that folks want to be identified, so that we can actually call them the names they want to be called and call them the pronouns they want to be called.
Yeah, but
everybody's
not always there to even recognize that everybody's not defining themselves the way they want. Everybody's not at a place where they can see beyond the binary. And so when you introduce
Amen.
Something else,
you're absolutely right.
When you introduce something else, they go bonkers. So, you know, to me, I'm still saying that even though I was beyond that point, when it's faced with me directly to think about it like that, it was interesting to see my reaction internally. But also the young man who did the facilitation, he later on revealed that he was not only what he appeared to be African American, but he introduced that he was Nigerian American.
mm-hmm.
And I loved it, because I said, see, this is why you can't go around assuming anything about anybody.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I think that's right. You know what it makes me think about? Makes me think about a lot the fact that, like, those assumptions are the things that happen when kids get bullied on the playground, right? Like, the fact of the matter is that the way that culture and our work as like artists and as theater companies actually impact, you know, what happens in the world has to do with how we are represented, and how is it okay to be the fullness of who it is that you are as a human being in the world. And a lot of the times the answer is no. you can't say that I'm a non-binary person. It's hard because it takes courage to do that. You have to be in a space that you will be made to feel safe, because otherwise people will look at you, you know, differently. People will treat you differently, those kinds of things. Discrimination is real in that way. You know what I mean? And so I'm really thankful and happy that you're sharing this experience with me, because I hope that that's actually something that we do at Woolly Mammoth through our plays too, is that you see a play and you're sort of noticing something about yourself and about the world around you that you may not have noticed before.
And so to loop this back around to human resources, I think that if you have never been to Woolly before, for $7, you'll get a quick introduction with what Woolly Mammoth is about, and that it's not predictable. And that if you want to come and have someone sing to you A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you're not going to get that.
You might get that, but with like an amazing beat underneath it, you'll get like some, some real like surprising elements. Something happens on top of it. It's not going to be status quo. Let me tell you, it's not going to be status quo.
Okay, that's a good way of describing it. But it's going to be something besides water that you can get off the street for free. So that's one thing. That's one thing I like about human resources. It initially, I had to just go back and think, okay, this is Woolly Mammoth, so there's a little bit more to this than what meets the eye. And yes, once I let my barriers go, I enjoyed it. Well,
I'm
like
so glad about it.
Well, just let me just double check and make sure that our other guests didn't use a different telephone to come on. So, no, they're gone now. So maybe that was a caller who was just listening, but that's fine. We welcome people to listen in that format as well. But let's talk more about how you get onto human resources. And I know that it's $7, and you can buy it safely online, by phone, or via email.
Yeah, totally. And you just go, you know, woollymammoth.net is our website. You can go on there. You can buy tickets. And essentially what happens is we give you the code, and you get a special code that is unique to you to listen to the hotline. And you don't have to listen all at once. You can listen actually over the course of 4 days. So you have access to the hotline for 4 days. It's like a 4-day window. And so you can listen to and follow your way through to, you know, for 5 minutes, and then the next day come back in for 10 minutes, and you can sit down and listen to it, pop open a bottle of wine and, you know, make yourself a little charcuterie plate, you know, put your feet up and just play around with human resources, the hotline, and see where it gets you, see where it takes you, all the adventure, you know?
And Access gives you Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, so you have 4 days, correct? Or did you just
mention
that already?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and I really want people to find the super secret happiness code.
And that I totally missed.
Tell me.
So can you explain that? Because I totally missed that.
Well, so we'll send it to you. I'll make sure Naomi can get you that code so you can listen to it and you can hear it. Because I don't want to give it away to anybody. I want people to try and find it. But what I will say is let me give a little bit of, I'll give a little bit of a carrot, which is, go down the rabbit hole of technical support. And, and there is treasure at the end of that adventure.
Oh, now you got me wanting to know what it is, even more so.
I know, so maybe you're just going to have to go back in and listen and take your time and play around.
Oh, that's why, because, you know, it breaks the day up. And even now, being stuck in the house and with limited things to do, even the reruns on TV are starting to become boring. So this would be great.
Well, so I am really excited that you were able to let go and enjoy yourself listening to it. And I hope that other people will do the same. We made it a low price point so that everybody could actually, you know, get on and, you know, have the experience that they, you know, whatever experience it you want, you know what I mean? Depends on your mood. You know, you might go down the technical support rabbit hole, or you go down the other one, you know?
And one thing we're going to talk about is how long these little vignettes are. And I think they're about 3 to 5 minutes long.
Yeah, about that. But some of them are much shorter. And it really is, it's like what you said at the top of the of this segment, is that basically because it's a phone tree, right, you're making decisions at every single moment. So it's like press one, press two, plus three, and then if you press three, it gives you another menu and that kind of stuff. And then you you basically come upon a kind of different experience, and there are different ones for each one in the menu.
Okay. So, Maria, what's next for Woolly Mammoth? I'm not too sure if D.C. plans to open anytime soon or they plan to open on a limited basis, but what's the story on that at this point? Do you know?
Well, my understanding is, you know, they're trying to get the schools open. November 9th is what Mayor Bowser said. So and they are doing a pilot program with the Kennedy Center and with Gala Hispanic and some other organizations in D.C. to try to reopen entertainment venues and sort of pilot what that could be or look like. So I feel really optimistic about that. I am a glass half full person, I will say. So we'll see what happens, but if children are able to go back to school, I hope that we would be able to come back soon after that. What's next for us is we're actually going to be announcing a play that was written specifically for Zoom. So Zoom is that video conferencing software. And one of the things that's been happening is I've been seeing theater on digitally, but it hasn't been written for that medium, right? And this is the thing about the Telephonic Literary Union that gets me excited. It's like all of the stuff that we did with the telephone hotline was written for the telephone, right? With that experience in mind. And what we did was we commissioned a writer to actually write with the Zoom digital experience in mind. And so I'm really excited because we're going to be doing that. We're going to start rehearsal soon. We haven't announced it yet, but you're getting a little sneak preview.
Hey, love it.
The fact that we're I know. Getting a little sneak preview that we're going to be announcing that we're going to do that soon enough. But, you know, we're also in the process of putting together all the shows that are going to happen in the winter, spring. We've got a show called Black is Beautiful, but it sure ain't pretty. And it is a show with it's great. Two amazing performers. One of them is Kareem Lucas. And then the other person, wait for it, is his actual mother. He is literally on stage with his mother, and he is talking about trying to find, you know, love and intimacy in the world and his encounters with women. And he has his literal mother on stage keeping him honest. That's Black is Beautiful, but it sure ain't pretty. So we're going to be doing that in the spring. I'm hoping that we'll be able to actually gather in person in small numbers, you know, because Woolly Mammoth can do it for, you know, 25, 30 people, but we will also have a way to be able to see it digitally if folks aren't feeling comfortable or haven't been vaccinated by then yet.
Wow. Well, you know, I want to go back to the Zoom and not go too far or not have to give up too much at this point. But in theory, that sounds... Okay, we have 90 seconds left, but in theory, I can hear it. But in practice, can you give me one example of what that means to have something written for Zoom versus on stage?
Yeah. So one quick example is this. The reason we are on Zoom watching that play is because the two characters are talking to each other on Zoom specifically. It is a father and a son drama. The father is in Ramallah in Palestine, and the son is in, you know, London or New York, and they haven't seen each other in years. And so we're watching them talking to each other on Zoom, cooking together, because they're on Zoom cooking together. And so that's what makes it so that it's specific, right?
Right. Okay, that's interesting. Well, I'm telling you, I'm looking forward to both of them. And I'm saying the second one you mentioned, the title itself is so catchy, maybe even a little bit shocking. But again, I expect it to be good because it's coming from Woolly.
I appreciate you. I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much for being a fan. And I'm just thrilled about being able to talk to you and your listeners about everything that we're doing. I really appreciate your support. And stay safe, my friend. Wear a mask.
Thank you so much. And that ends today's program. This is Wayne Young again with Maria of Woolly Mammoth Theater. And you can read more and see us at portofharlem.net. There's a whole story on Woolly Mammoth's new play, Human Resources, and also links to Woolly Mammoth at portofharlem.net. And also, please like us on Facebook. Have a good one.
Take care.